Excuse me, everyone, and thank you for standing by. I'd like to inform all participants that today's conference call is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect your line at this time, and you may begin.
Thank you, Laurie. This is NCSG Policy Committee meeting in Queens Key 1 at 9:07 a.m. on Monday, October 15th. Please go ahead.
Thank you. Thank you. Hi, my name is Robin Gross. I'm the chair of the Non-Commercial Stakeholder Group, and this is the Policy Committee meeting for the Non-Commercial Stakeholders Group. And let me just quickly go through the main agenda items. First, we're going to talk about the RAA negotiations, and Becky Burr and Matt Sterling have graciously agreed to join us and give us an update on that as they've been preparing and participating in that. And then we'll talk about some of the IPR issues and new GTLDs. And then we'll talk about the issues, the rights for the Olympic Committee, the Red Cross, the intergovernmental organization issue. And then we'll talk about who is. And then we'll talk about new GTLDs and free expression concerns. And then I wanted to talk about some of the possible motions that are on the or that were on the GNSO agenda for this week. I'm not really sure what to deal with them, but maybe the counselors can give us some update. Consumer metrics and ATRT work. So those are the main, those are the big policy issues on our agenda this morning, which is not posted on the meetings page. If anyone wants to know where the agenda is posted, it's posted to the NCSG meetings page. Okay, so welcome. Welcome, everyone. And let me just ask that you please state your name when you begin to speak for purposes of the recording and transcription. And let's start with the first issue on our agenda, which is the RAA amendments, the Registrar Accreditation Amendments issue. And we haven't, NCSG hasn't been participating directly in those because we're not a contract to the parties, but we're very lucky that some of the participants who are, have been engaged in those negotiations are here to update us on what's been happening on that since our last meeting in Prague. So with that, let me turn it over to Becky, and if you could update us. And thank you so much for coming. I really appreciate this.
Our pleasure. There are a lot of issues in the RAA negotiations that affect stakeholders, registrants throughout, and so it's very important, and I want to say that we appreciate the attention and the interest that we've gotten from other stakeholders in this, because sometimes it feels like we're kind of talking to walls. We, as you all know, ICANN published a draft of its version of the RAA agreement in June, which was obviously had a lot of provisions that were reflected the sort of unnegotiated law enforcement asks in the case of data retention and in the case of some of the verification provisions, and also included a lot of ICANN asks that are very troubling, I think, from a couple of perspectives, and then did not include some of the things that the registrars have asked for as a way of facilitating quicker decision-making and a better, more transparent arrangement. Since then, we've met a couple of times. So I'll take the big issues. Law enforcement clarified its request for data collection and retention in May, I think. And so the language that was in the June agreement reflected a very, very long, very detailed laundry list of items to be collected and, in all cases, to be retained for the life of the registration plus 2 years. And that included things like web logs and credit card details. And, I mean, nobody keeps web logs for the life of registration, which could be, you know, which could be unending, really, because if you extend it. So the registrars put on the table a counterproposal, which was essentially a certain basic information would be retained for the life of the of the registration plus 2 years, names of the registrant and that kind of stuff, which would typically be retained. And then a minimum 180-day retention for certain transactional information. And again, all of this would be subject to any exceptions needed to comply with applicable law. As somebody suggested yesterday, the 180-day period was, in fact, selected to be consistent with the EU Data Retention Directive, which establishes a minimum hold of 6 months for things like IP addresses. And our theory was, if an IP address is not going to be, you know, matchable after 6 months in those countries that have adopted the lesser standard, then there's no reason to keep it. But there are, of course, countries in the European Union that have rejected the six-month minimum. So countries in Germany, for example, is one place where even that six-month period would not be acceptable. We have reached agreement with law enforcement and ICANN on the two-tiered scaled back, and I want to be sure everybody understands that also includes a lot less detail. They asked for a huge amount of detail on payment information, which is not good practice to maintain. It's, you know, dangerous information that can be used for identity theft, and so we rejected that request. I think we have reached a sort of consensus among parties on that piece. There is still a question about what the process by which an exception would be requested. So that's one of the outstanding items. On the verification, the registrars were very clear early on that they would not accept a pre-resolution verification solution. That was a big concern of law enforcement, but the registrar's position is very clear. It was hard work to get support for the notion of a post-resolution validation process among the registrars for the following reason, because I want to be clear that there is any validation process will have a significant impact on the way people access registration services. There's going to be a potential for an email, you know, getting not responded to, whatever, just any kind of consumer confusion. And there is a great deal of skepticism. Now, let me say this in the most polite way, a great deal of skepticism that this is going to have any impact on Whois accuracy or cutting down on, botnets or whatever. And so the position that the registrars have taken is we're all for Whois accuracy, but if you are going to introduce changes that are, one, going to have potentially very significant impacts, and it's not just a cost issue. And you have fundamental questions about whether it's going to do any good. You ought to take it slow and gather some data and learn how registrants are affected in the process. So what we have proposed is a post-resolution either email or telephone text verification, which basically, you know, demonstrates that there's a working email address or a working telephone or text receipt, and basically a registrar would need to do that within 15 days of the registration, and if they were unable to, they would need to suspend the registration until they could validate it. There's also a question on the table about how often that gets revalidated. And although we understand the concerns of law enforcement, we think that the only thing that makes sense is that there's a revalidation if you're put on notice in some way that there's a problem with the address, as in you send out your annual Whois accuracy notice and it bounces or something like that. That's still the position of the registrars, we don't think that there's any possibility of getting consensus about anything further. Law enforcement has sort of suggested, well, how about both telephone and email? We're not quite sure what the principal basis for those requests are, but we really think this is as much as is doable. The other issue that's very important, so those are the two sort of law enforcement issues that are open. In all of the other ones, we've reached some accommodation that the registrars think is reasonable and that attempts to answer what we thought the legitimate questions and concerns were. There are a bunch of other issues that don't get too much attention paid to them, and so just want to talk briefly about those. ICANN had requested some very significant changes to the consensus policy picket fence arrangement, and I, as the person who sat at the table when the original picket fence deal was struck, tend to feel very strongly about the importance of preserving that as a kind of fundamental basis of bargaining and a fundamental protection against overreaching. That over time, the language in the registrar's accreditation agreement with respect to consensus policy has sort of become muddied. There was a lot of work by the community in cleaning that up in the context of the new GTLD registry agreement. And so we proposed to essentially adopt that statement of consensus policy for the registrars. For one thing, it reflects the original language, and for another, in a world in which vertical integration of registries and registrars is going to be permitted, it's very hard to understand why you would have two separate statements of consensus policy. It's not clear where this is going to come out. And at some level, ICANN has sort of said, well, there are some things in there that you guys agreed to in 2009 or before, and you ought to leave them in. I think that's one of the issues that we're still need to discuss. And that's very important to get a very clear and crisp understanding of the picket fence and how it operates. One example I'll give you is that forever the statement on something that's within the picket fence is disputes regarding the registration but not the content of names, and that but not the content was really a very fundamental. I remember exactly the moment that it was agreed upon. The registrar's statement now says something like disputes about the registration of a domain name, including policies related to the use of domain names. And I think that gets very close to a content regulation or to sort of deputizing registrars as arms of law enforcement, which I would like to get away from. There are some other issues in that, but that's one issue that is open. The other open issue is that ICANN has asked for the ability to revoke the registrar agreement for reasons that we cannot figure out. There are plenty of ways to terminate the agreement or to modify the agreement. We have, for example, proposed an amendment process that, along the lines of the new GTLD registry agreement, which would permit a change in the agreement to become binding across the entire registrar group if it was supported by a certain percentage of registrars representing a certain percentage of registrations. We've also, of course, there's the consensus policy amendment for stability and security. And so this revocation issue, which was an issue that ICANN proposed in the new GTLD agreement, is sort of unexplained to us as to why it's needed. And frankly, in a conversation last night with a registrar, it's like, is there, like, would you ever sign an agreement that says, you know, when we get tired of this, we can just terminate it for no reason? So that is still on the table. Yes. Well, I mean, just to be...
Milton Mueller.
Just to be clear, I mean, part of the whole issue around these law enforcement requests is what is the role of the registrars with respect to sort of crime prevention and policing. And I think we need to be clear about the notion that, you know, registrars obviously should not engage in practices that are, you know, abusive of consumers. Registrars should not, you know, where they have clear knowledge of things that are against their policies, they should enforce those policies. But the notion that we're going to put a whole bunch of regulatory agreements into the registrar agreement that essentially puts registrars at risk for losing their accreditation if they don't affirmatively police certain behaviors is troublesome to me. Well, there are all kinds of things, language. I mean, some of this is now resolved, but like knowingly permitting cyber squatting. I mean, it's just things like sort of knowingly permitting, and then there's no definition. The question is, how do you know if there's no finding by a regulator or a court that somebody has engaged in behavior that, or consumer fraud or whatever? I mean, I'll give you a good real life example of this in a slightly different context. There have been, from time to time, issues with notices about renewal, you know, renew your domain name, the sort of deceptive renew your domain name letters, which are really like slamming, it's sort of old-fashioned getting you to change registrar thing. And so, you know, one question is, what are the registrars going to do about the fact that somebody's engaged in bad behavior? Well, and then report it to the FTC, get law enforcement involved, you know, whatever. But is it really the place of registrars to enforce, you know, against the group, to be the judge and jury on consumer protection rules? I'm not saying that these are not important issues, and they're clearly important issues to the registrar group. But there is this weird notion somehow that in a world in which people are operating under enormously varied legal regimes, somehow we're going to sort of replace the traditional role of law enforcement with some self-regulatory stuff. It's worrisome, and I think that's just, we have to be very, very clear about what the lines are and what the responsibilities of the registrars are and what the responsibilities of ICANN are, for example. I mean, you know, I think there's a tough call on whether, you know, ICANN is in a position to determine whether something is deceptive under Section 5 of the Federal Trade Commission Act. So it's that kind of issue that I'm kind of worried about generally. So then there are a couple of other issues that the registrars have asked for some relief. One is with respect to the obligation to provide bulk access to WHOIS data in the context of that's a provision that was put in for a very specific reason when Network Solutions owned all of the registration data, and the notion was they had such a lock on the data that they could prevent value-added products and services being developed. Now that the registrar's world is very competitive, it's hard to justify that. So there's that request is out there. And then there also is a request for registrars not to have to provide certain kinds of who is in the context of thick, you know, the online who is lookup as a supplement to the in a thick registry where that is being provided by the registry itself. And what the registrars do is point back out to the registry's the registry's thick who is. And so the requirement to keep providing that, particularly in a world where you have 1,900 new GTLDs and there's going to be a lot of overhead on that, that's sort of in there completely. I think Matt could probably explain it better than I just did. But again, that's one of the things that I can quite concerned that if we take away something, even though there's a really good explanation, the community will have no tolerance for like why something is being taken away. They won't be able to understand that.
So there particularly, I'm puzzled by who ICANN thinks is the community and how we can show them that the community is, in fact, far broader, and some parts of the community would very much agree with the registrars here.
Well, you can stand up and say, I mean, you know, that's the kind of feedback that we're looking to get from the community, quote-unquote, during the RIA session. You know, the goal is for folks to be able to have an opportunity to say exactly that to staff. So say exactly that to staff.
And I think really there is this notion that if we make, I mean, we're talking about changes that will look fairly dramatic because there's a lot of cleanup and rationalizing the contract and moving things into appendix so that it mirrors the new GTLD registry. And the staff is very concerned that people just say, oh, my God, where did that sentence go? Or where did the, and so they kind of want to stick with the really messy document that we have just because there's some concern that the community will not take the time to look at the agreement carefully and understand what's going on. And I think the community is smarter than that.
Milton Mueller. So what is the role? What can you tell us about the role of the staff in these negotiations from the standpoint of, you know, ICANN process is working? I mean, I understand when you do things like this unilateral revocation, as stupid as it is, at least I understand how they're negotiating for their own interest as a corporation. But when they're, you know, negotiating these law enforcement issues, it seems to me they're kind of in a position to be making policy almost, almost legislating. And what seems to be driving them? Is it external pressure from this, the board, or is it from, you know, political pressure from outside? And how do we, you know, counter that?
So the whole question about whether there's policy making and whether there needs to be a PDP and all of that, I am now absolutely convinced that the community in general needs to have a sort of very serious focused discussion about the policy development process, the picket fence policy, you know, consensus policy, those whole things, because there is a lot of stuff that gets loaded onto that, and I think there's not clarity about that, and the language in the bylaws, by the way, is inherently, it's just very confusing. So, so let me just say, you raise an issue that I think is a topic of significance outside of this, and a lack of clarity. The staff, I believe, was essentially instructed with regards to the law enforcement request to negotiate, to use the law enforcement request as the basis for negotiation. It has been complicated because law enforcement has kind of changed its requests over time, including, you know, as recently as the month before the June document. They're negotiating for their own corporate interests on other things. They are negotiating out of a concern about what the sort of community perception will be on some things. On the law enforcement request, they had really basically taken the position that that was sort of where they were coming from. And And frankly, we've had direct interactions with law enforcement and really reached acceptable, not overreaching arrangements on 11 and a half of the points, and law enforcement has backed off some of the points that have been more, you know, unsupportable. But in this regard, it has been difficult because the staff has not been really come to the table as a negotiator with respect to the law enforcement request. Having said that, I think we've managed to have very good conversations with law enforcement, and we have sort of overcome that piece of it. But with respect to the law enforcement policies, it was those 12 requests that they put on the table were sort of their position.
Thank you. This is Robin. What's the time frame for going forward with these negotiations?
So we, on July 17th or something like that, responded again to their June 3rd draft. We've had some negotiating sessions since then, both with law enforcement and with ICANN, and resolved some issues. The registrars have a text on the table. We need to fill in a couple of pieces, like with respect to the percentages and whatever. But the registrars have on the table the text of the agreement that we think is doable and can be signed. At this point, we think there's no point in further extended negotiations. ICANN has to respond to us on the things like, you know, the entire agreement and every commercial aspect of it is not within the picket fence, it was one position that they've taken, that you can't revoke, just, you know, that revocation provision is unacceptable, dealing with the asks that the registrars put on the table in a couple of other areas, and then identifying some incentive for having registrars move to the new agreement. But basically, we are ready to, we think we have gotten as far as we have gotten, and we are at the point of diminishing returns on negotiations. ICANN, I believe, wants to wrap this up and issue a document for public input, comment, et cetera, by the end of this year. And although I feel like the timing is sort of out of our hands, that's perfectly doable, but there's not a lot of more negotiating room, frankly. So it's really a question of when they get back to us. But I believe that they will say the goal is to put something out for public comment by the end of the year.
I'm sorry. Do you know if the Article 29 letter that NCUC solicited had any impact, or what was the reaction from the negotiators or from the staff or law enforcement that you're aware of on that?
So, I mean, the Article 29 and then the Council of Europe letter were focused on the June 3rd draft, which had, in particular, this, you know, ridiculous save all law web logs for the life of the registration plus 2 years, which we had said from the beginning was absolutely not it wouldn't comply with anybody's legal requirements where data protection regulations would limit that, and it would not, you know, our goal was to provide sensible retention that was largely going to be set a level playing field across the board, that it made no sense to have a situation where registrars in jurisdictions without the same kind of data protection laws were disadvantaged, and so you had to reach something that was going to be largely acceptable across the registrar body, but for limited exceptions. So we had already put that on the table. It was a very helpful to have that, reiterated, although, frankly, I think we had beaten law enforcement into submission on that point by the time it came out. And I think that the letter is also useful on the validation issue. I think it demonstrated that we weren't just making it up, or you couldn't just say, you know, this is all voluntary. Nobody has to have a domain name, so, you know, everybody can consent. There is a little bit of tension, which if you were at the JNSO meeting, you may have noticed, because the GAC basically, I mean, we've been saying for a long time, we love the GAC, we love law enforcement. We understand that data protection authorities believe that they have an independent voice and often exercise it, and, you know, we're raising issues and we think these people should be at the table. And the GAC basically said, sorry, it's our job to consult with the data protection authorities, and when we come to the table, we can speak for our data protection authorities. Now, that was, you know, I don't know what inspired that GAC position. I'm not even going to contemplate what inspired it. It was not something that people who deal with the international data protection laws would have believed would be the case. And we did have conversations with law enforcement where, you know, somebody would say, well, under the Data Protection Directive X, Y, and Z, and I would say, oh, has the Data Protection Authority agreed with you? And the answer was, well, this is our interpretation of what a reasonable interpretation would be. But we really hope to avoid getting in the GAC's face on this one, because we actually do believe we have reached a solution that is that's reasonable and that will address data protection concerns. It was useful because, frankly, my credibility in talking about German data protection laws, although I actually do know quite a lot about it, is sort of nuts. But just to be clear, it has kind of been overtaken by events, and we really don't want to have this issue where the GAC feels like it needs to have a fight with ICANN or vice versa about, you told us not to consult the data protection authorities, and now they're coming in and doing this.
Alain Béranger, I'm new to the stakeholders group, so this question may have been asked before or may be naive. When you talk about law enforcement authorities, which country or countries are you talking with?
There have been a lot of members of European law enforcement, EU, Interpol, the Serious Organized Crime Agency in the UK, plus the U.S., FBI, Justice Department, Federal Trade Commission. Those have been largely involved. However, there have been sort of other offline areas in parallel, 2 days worth of law enforcement working together here, and I think it's a much broader group than that. It's not just U.S. law enforcement. Oh, the Royal Canadian Mounted Police have been very involved in it. And I think that there have probably been some Australian law enforcement folks.
So it would be right to say that developing countries and maybe even the BRIC countries are a little bit outside that discussion?
Well, the other thing that the GAC has said is basically, we represent law enforcement as well. And there is not, the developing countries are represented they're certainly represented in the GAC. And it's my impression, at least, that there has been a pretty consistent GAC support for law enforcement, those law enforcement requests across the board, whether or not they have actually had local law enforcement directly at the table. So while it feels kind of like the developed country's law enforcement, it is endorsed by a more diverse GAC. Now, I don't know you know, I don't know what else we can do, but I think as far as we know, it is fairly supported by the variety of countries participating in the GAC.
Kathy Kleinman, first I apologize for coming in late. And second, thank you. I mean, these negotiations have been going on for a long time. There's a lot of tough negotiations in ICANN, it's probably ring. And I know so many registrars, you guys have gone to the mat to protect registrant rights. ICANN staff hasn't been the front line, but for all right, you get that. Thank you. I apologize if you already talked about it, but the two big issues we talked about in Prague were data retention and verifying contact information, whether to verify before, correct me if I get this wrong, whether you have to verify the data before you get a domain name or after, and whether it would be email or telephone or one or the other or both. And so, again, forgive me if you've already answered. I want to know where these things are, you know, where did it come out?
So just quickly, on data retention, as we talked about, the request for collect everything you can, keep it forever, was a non-starter always. We've arrived at consensus around a very scaled-back two-tiered approach that would have a six-month minimum for certain transactional data subject to applicable law, because in some places the 6 months will not be acceptable.
So that's IP addresses used during the transaction?
Payment information, that kind of stuff. And then life of the registration plus 2 years for things like the name of the registrant, the kind of stuff that would be retained for the life of the registration anyway.
Kind of the who was information?
Well, I mean, it's going to be, but, you know, who has this registration during the period in which it's registered? So I think we feel that we have a workable compromise on that creates a level playing field that does not have people collecting, you know, information that can be misused for identity theft and that kind of stuff for really long periods of time. The who is the validation before or after? I mean, I think this is an area in which the rights of registrants has been very much a focus here, and although you know, there is a tendency to sort of shortstop this as the registrars just don't want to make this more expensive, there is a fundamental realization that that any of these steps, even the post-resolution validation, is going to have a fairly significant impact on the way people access registration services. And there are significant questions about whether the changes that have been requested are actually going to produce meaningful results in increasing who is accuracy or reducing fraud. And so the registrars have not changed their position. They will do either email or telephone within 15 days of the registration. And that was very hard to get agreement on, not because you know, registrars don't want to be bothered to do it, but because there is a strong feeling that this is not going to solve any of the problems. So the position of the registrars is, and it will not change, they will do one or the other post-resolution. They will be engaged in continuing discussion on, you know, sort of ways in which to increase the accuracy of who is. You know, before we turn this system on its head, we ought to know who it's going to affect, how it's going to affect them, and whether it's going to produce meaningful results in consumer protection.
Thank you. Awesome.
Thank you. This is Robin. Let me just ask. Well, as you know, we're concerned about the privacy rights and the rights of registrants in these negotiations. So where would you see at this point some leverage or a lever point, some place where we could get involved, where we could have an impact or something we could do? Do you have any suggestions for that?
I think, frankly, that there has been some, you know, there may have communication between the board and the staff, and it may not have been entirely perfect. And I think that the board needs to hear that the community is not unengaged in these discussions, and the community recognizes that 11.5 of the law enforcement requests have been accomplished, and that there are, issues about ICANN overreaching and issues about privacy and issues about, making this system workable are important. And this is not just about registrars being lazy or unwilling to, do work. Now, I think we started to hear that in Prague, and I think that was useful, and I think it will be important. I mean, what I would like to hear is the community say, okay, guys, it's been a formal negotiation for a year. You've made huge progress. Why don't you, capture the progress and not drag this out for another 27 years, which, will just do me in. 27 minutes sometimes feels hard.
Okay, thank you. So it sounds like you're suggesting that we really focus our energy on the board at this point and have the board here from us.
In the GNSO session, too, I think, some board members will be there. I don't know how many. But I think that what the staff needs to hear is that the community is going to be thoughtful about looking at the changes and not react to, oh, this line has changed or that line has changed. But we understand that there are big changes here. And because what they're really reacting to now is if we take that word out, then somebody's going to jump down our throat. And so I think that, the notion that there's recognition that this is a major overhaul that involves a lot of changes that addresses, moving things into alignment, cleaning up, that things are going to be different, that the community is going to look at this from a thoughtful perspective, and there's not going to be this sort of reaction. You didn't get all 12 of and every aspect of the law enforcement request, that's one thing they're worried about. You changed some word that I had, some deep investment in. This is complex. There's been a lot of work. It's been good work, and the community is smart enough and thoughtful enough to evaluate it on those grounds.
No, I mean, I think that's right. During the public session today, Monday,
yeah.
The public session today and in the GNSO meeting on Wednesday, and then, remember, once we have a final, quote-unquote, RAA, it'll go after public comment as well. So there's an opportunity, and we fully expect that comment will be taken back by staff, and then we will, at some level, have to revisit some of the issues that are raised during the public comment period as well.
So if ICANN puts out its draft for public comment by the end of the year, where would you anticipate we would be on this in the next ICANN meeting in Beijing in April? What stage is this?
I haven't done the calculations, but my sense is that they want to, if they post by the end of the year, then they would take the public comments and then have a, and then hope to have a final, any revisions made by Beijing would be my, just on the face of it, would be what my expectation would be.
I understand that there's a website out there with different drafts and comments back and forth from formal documents from registrars and staff.
Yeah, it's not well found, frankly. It's on their wiki page, is my understanding. And I actually honestly haven't looked at it because we have all the 75,000 emails back and forth. But it is up on the wiki page. We'll find it and send it to you.
And is there a public comment going on?
Right? No, but my understanding is that you can always submit comments through the wiki itself, so that at any point anyone can submit comments to that.
Could you send us the link to the wiki then?
Yeah.
So that we can. Okay.
Yeah.
I am, I believe, the only person who has ever submitted comments on the wiki, and I have never gotten any acknowledgement of them. But
all right, you can submit them, but they're where they go is a whole other.
In that case, which I can staff the ECC on the comments.
Margie.
Huh?
Yeah.
Is there anything we should be doing?
I mean, I think that we need to see how ICANN responds to certain of the things that they've put on the table. I mean, I think that, you know, the position on revocation, we have no idea what the world will look like. Therefore, we need to have the ability to do anything we want is a very worrisome attitude. It's not new. It was highly involved in the negotiations on the GTLD agreement. One of the other things that is clearly true in my discussions with law enforcement, they say, well, I want this word here and I want that word there. And you kind of say, and it turns out that they're negotiating against the ICANN says it can't enforce this or that provision because the language isn't clear enough. I'm very hopeful that the move that Fadi made with enforcement might make the world a better place in that regard. Frankly, there are real problems about ICANN's enforcement, and they were sort of surprised to hear that the registrar sitting around the table really wanted them to enforce their agreement because
it creates a level playing field among the registrars, and it means that the registrar. Let me just expand it because I thought it was brilliant when I heard it, and I think it's right. That the registrars that are the good actors, for lack of a better word, I know we misuse that, but the ones who are expending the time and the effort to fulfill the agreement are spending a lot more money and effort than those who aren't doing what they're supposed to under the contract. So to create a level playing field in a highly competitive industry, it would help if everyone obeyed the same rules or followed the same contract.
Yeah. No. The other thing that I think you should be concerned about is the creation of the privacy proxy accreditation, because I made the point, if you were in the GNSO session on Saturday, I made the point that we feel very strongly that is a PDP issue that should go through and I have heard informally that is not the opinion that staff may end up having. So I would, you know, and I think Milton, you stated during the session as well that, you know, if anything is, you know, I don't know if you called it a poster child for the PDP, but that very clear. So, you know, the more people that we can sing that tune, because, you know, it concerns me deeply if we try to create that outside of the established policy development process.
Okay. Well, anyone else have any other questions on this issue? No? Okay. Thank you both. Thank you. This was really incredibly helpful. Thank you. We will try to do what we can to support you guys. Thank you. Okay. Okay, so should we take a 5-minute break and then we'll come back and talk about the IPR issues, the new GTLDs? Okay, so let's, this is Robin Gross. We're back in the non-commercial stakeholder group policy meeting. And the next issue on our agenda is the IPR issues and new GTLDs. And we're very lucky that Kathy Kleiman is with us today, and she has been working very hard on the Universal Rapid Suspension Proposal, the URS, and can give us an update on that. And then we can talk about the Trademark Clearinghouse, and Wendy's been following that. So and then we can sort of talk about some of the alternative proposals and how to respond to that. So let me just turn it over to Kathy first, and if you could tell us a little bit about the URS and what's happening there and what we should be concerned about and what you suggest we do.
I suggest we find other people to work on IPR. We're very, very, with the loss of Constantino's, we are way too implementation time. So let me share first just a little bit of background for those who haven't lived through this and had the blood, sweat, and tears of the last 5 years. I've moved up into your space. I'll take some people. Thanks for sharing. By way of background, with the new top-level domains were coming out, the intellectual property community came forward in great numbers to try to seek intellectual property protection. For everyone who knows, they created the IRT report. The acronym and what it stands for isn't really important. It was a set of brand new intellectual property protection mechanisms in the new top-level domains. The proposals weren't very fair or balanced, and they'd come out of a completely one-sided committee. So we went to the GNSO, and we asked for a team across the community to review this and see if it was fair and balanced. And we went in and we fought for due process. There was no due process. Basically, I called it accuse you lose, and this is all the way back in Sydney, Australia, that as long as you were accused of some kind of problem with your domain name, you lost it. And that didn't seem to be fair for nonprofit organizations, for advocacy organizations, for organizations that critique and criticize large companies and use trademarks to do it, which is completely legal in most countries. But the whole idea of a lack of due process was just infuriating. And we built in a lot of due process through this committee called the SCI, the Special Trademarks Initiative. And the GNSO Council adopted the SCI recommendations unanimously, which were revisions to all these intellectual property protections, but a little more fair, thinking a little bit not just about the plaintiff, but about the defendant. It was a little more fair. It was adopted unanimously. The chair, Chuck Gomes of the GNSO Council, said it was one of the best efforts he'd ever seen, most cooperative efforts. In 6 weeks, we did a year's worth of work. So there are a lot of intellectual property protection mechanisms in the new top-level domains. The main one still at issue is called the Uniform Rapid Suspension. Quicker, faster, cheaper way to take down domain names that you don't like. Real fear is that with 1,000 new top-level domains, there's going to be a lot of cyber squatting. So we really wanted a 3-week response time because that's how long it takes. When you get a notice from one of these dispute providers, first it goes into your spam filter because you've never heard from them before. It's a new email address. Then maybe if you're lucky, you get it out of the spam filter. And then for small organizations, for small businesses, for individuals engaged in free speech and freedom of expression activities, you have to find someone who can help you respond. It takes a while. The board cut the response time down to 2 weeks, and now they would like to be an audit. Now, but we said, and we wrote it into the applicant guidebook, guys, black letter rules say that even if the registrant doesn't respond, there has to be a full evaluation of the issue. So let's say it's an Amnesty International group or a Falun Gong group. Maybe they put inaccurate information into the who is. Maybe they don't choose to respond. Maybe they can't respond. But still, someone should be sitting there, a trademark attorney, who knows that there are fair use protections, that there are, you know, freedom of expression protections. Someone should sit there and look at it. The intellectual property community has recently come back, and it's not really our guys. It's really interesting. It's not really the ICANN intellectual property guys. They've signed off on this, and to their credit, they keep saying they've signed off on it. I'm really proud. John Nevitt, Paul McGrady, Mark Partridge, in Prague there was a session on this, and to their credit, they defended the compromise. They said, look, we've argued every period, every cross T, you know, everything's been negotiated. Don't mess with this, guys. But I have letters here. The U.S. Department of Commerce is under siege. I mean, I'm serious, siege by intellectual property owners generally from outside ICANN who are still very concerned about what's going on. They created associations like CADNA, and they still bang on the Department of Commerce's door every day about this. So one of the proposals, and I'm furious about it, is automatic default. If you don't show up, you lose. I'm like, no. Or automatic default unless you pay. Like loser pays. Well, obviously, if you don't know what's going on, you can't. And so I'm like, oh, come on. And so we had another URF session. It was, again, presented. Another problem, though, is that the price point, the World Intellectual Property Organization, a group called NAF, the National Arbitration Forum, handle a lot of the UDRPs. And, you know, the traditional, the domain name disputes under current existing GTLDs. And they've come back and said the URS would be expensive. Because, of course, they don't want their own business undercut. I mean, there are all sorts of reasons for that. And so basically what the entire GNSO community active on this has come back with is use your computers, guys. Automate. Go faster. Make faster decisions. You know, batch it. Basically, the idea is if you have to spend more than 10 or 15 minutes evaluating a URF complaint, a Uniform Rapid Suspension complaint, you're in the wrong forum. This is not a group to look at evidence. It's not a group to look at briefs. It's supposed to be quick and fast and dirty and clear. And if it's not there, so I wrote an article in Circle ID that said, let's make that explicit. Create a procedural checkbox to get the poor trademark examiner off, you know, the person examining this, off the hook. Just check a box that says this doesn't belong in this forum. Take it somewhere else. Take it to court. Take it to the UDRP. It's too involved. I'm not making a decision up or down, because right now they make a decision up or down, and it may fall on their head that they made a decision down that was a big multinational company that maybe did have rights. It was just a little complicated. So I'd like to see a quick checkbox. Procedurally, I think that any of, you know, who are the attorneys in the room here who did this? I think we should all volunteer, and I think what should happen is a big stack. What you do to save time is give Robin five at a time, give Wendy five at a time, and then you can spend an hour going through and, you know, you kind of build for the group, and that should bring the cost down. The other thing, in addition to automatic default, they're now saying that we can reduce costs by having administrative processing of the claims. Administrative processing is code word for not having a lawyer look at it. And I threw a fit again. I'm like, no. I mean, I'm like, you have to have a lawyer. We're talking about freedom of expression, free speech, freedom of association, to use Aubrey's one. You know, you got to think about this stuff. And someone with some background has to know, you know, has to be looking at both sides. And so I just wanted to give you the code words for what to watch for and to help me please object that we want lawyers. They don't have to be celebrity lawyers. UDRP tends to hire celebrity lawyers. They don't have to be celebrity lawyers, but they do have to be trademark lawyers, grounded in trademark law and hopefully international trademark law, and no automatic defaults. Now, that's what's on the agenda now. Fortunately, ICANN finally did put out the solicitation for providers, so we're going to get more information about this. Formally, it had already been just informal. So hopefully now providers will come back with a request for proposal. Maybe new groups will come back. So that's good. That's going forward. But we don't want to change any of the substantive rules. And I think we're going to have to fight for that. Procedural rules, we can tweak a little bit, but not time frame and no administrative review. We don't want, because an administrative clerk is just going to sit there and say no, and turn everything down. I mean, there's something else on the horizon. So that's the URS going through the GNSO. But Bruce Tonkin, who's on the ICANN board, who's from Melbourne IT, has presented his own plan called Minimizing Harm. And harm stands for high at-risk marks. Minimizing harm, high at-risk marks. It's an acronym. And guys, it's maximizing harm. This is terrible stuff. This is maximizing harm, H-A-R-M, lowercase. Because what it does is it recreates the globally protected marks list of our lives. And it says, basically, if you're registered in five different regions, that you have protection across the board. First, you only have 2 days to respond, and then you lose, and then you can pay to get it back. 2 days. 3 weeks to 2 weeks to 2 days. And I don't like that. It recreates this globally protected marks list. It creates not just a trademark clearinghouse. Trademark clearinghouse makes sense to me. If you have a registered mark anywhere in the world, and any federally registered mark, you can put it in the trademark clearinghouse. And then it'll be there, and you can use it in all the sunrises. It's not automatic protection, but it's there, and it's validated. This creates a special high level of protection for a certain set of marks registered around the world. But it doesn't have a class. So let me explain. So Sun Microsystems, if it still existed, which it doesn't, so it's a good one to use. If Sun has trademarks in five different countries, then it could put itself into the special list that Bruce wants to create. And suddenly it's protected not just in electronics, not just in computers, but across all new top-level domains. So the implications are enormous, and this is why we fought the globally protected muscles for such a long time. And the fact that it's coming from a board member is concerning to me because the ICANN board believes it can create policy without going through policy development processes. So I don't know if it, there was a big session in Washington. Unfortunately, we couldn't get a member there, and it was on the second day of the Jewish New Year, so I couldn't go. But there was a lot of talk. There seems to be concern about it, but we need to watch this one, too, and make sure that it doesn't kind of gather steam behind the scenes. So if you hear anything about the report minimizing harm or Melbourne IT's proposal gaining momentum, please share it with everybody. Because right now it's not in the foreground, it is in the background, but that ability of it to be introduced directly by the board is scary.
So is that harm initiative, of course? Isn't that a blatant conflict of interest?
On the other hand, I don't think he's on the new DTLD committee. My guess is he's recused from that. I agree. A conflict of interest in that he's representing his client. Absolutely. Melbourne IT is representing their client constituency in this policy blatantly. Yeah.
I mean, I've got nothing against Bruce, but I think that is something which somebody needs to point out to him. Sorry. Fadi just talked 3 minutes ago about the basic of everything which ICANN is doing now has to be ethics, 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 ethics. You can read the transcript you said it 3 minutes ago. And this is, for me, one of these cases where that ethic clause has to be gripping. Nothing personal against Bruce, but that is a point which is so blatant, and everybody who see that will go after ICANN.
Completely agree. So one of the reasons I'm here now is because I'm stretched on all sides. I've just founded a group on the intellectual property, on the Internet protocol side, on IP numbers. So I've got a coalition going there, fighting for some of the same rights we fought for in the GNSO. We need some other people on the URF, and I'd love to work with other people and tell you where we've been and what the history is and help the next group go off and defend our URF rights.
Thanks, Kathy. What about going forward now? What's the timeline and sort of the next steps on this?
There is a URF session on Thursday at 11:45 to 1 p.m. Please come with me. We need to be up at the microphone saying no automatic default, no automatic default. We'll just keep saying that until maybe they get tired of hearing it. There are also trademark clearinghouse sessions, but maybe you'll be talking about that. Let's talk about the trademark clearinghouse for just a moment. So the URF is 11:45 to 1, and then there's going to be online sessions. There was already one online webinar attended by like 90 intellectual property attorneys and about three of us. There's probably more stuff coming up. And then there's informal discussions. So we just need people kind of meeting some of the intellectual property attorneys here and just making sure that we hold the line, again, on what's already written in the applicant guidebook.
Thank you. Thank you so much for that, Kathy. Wendy, can
we have any volunteers?
Yeah, do you have any volunteers?
Anybody want to help?
On the URF issue. I know there may be some Constantinos of students maybe available to help on this, but
I think everything you said is incredibly sensible. But how much? David Cake, I should have identified myself. How much can non-lawyers help on this one? Can non-lawyers help? It seemed to me on this issue that it gets into trademark law issues pretty quick.
Non-lawyers can help a lot because ultimately, you're going to be stuck responding to this, and so are non-lawyers all across the world who don't speak English as a first or even a second language. And congratulations if you get 2 days to respond, and, your first language is Cyrillic. Mm-hmm. So actually, we need non-lawyers up at the microphones, because I can respond to these things, and I can respond in 48 hours. but the rest of the world can't. And so we actually need real people talking about how difficult this is going to be and how much they're going to lose. Can you imagine you get up there and you put up a website, a .org, to talk about, you know, an election coming up or to respond to a debate or to talk about a consumer product that has enormous safety hazards that you just found out, or something terrible or a national disaster. And then it gets taken down quickly without real notice to you, and you lose that timing of what could really be amazing speech and trying to amazing outreach. It's just not right. So, yes, non-lawyers, please. And again, we can strategize, and we can give you the legal bit, but we need not. David, are you volunteering to come to the session with me? Excellent. Thursday, 11:45. Anyone else? Can anyone else come Thursday, 11:45? Okay. It looks like you want to talk. Do you want to? Oh, okay.
Anyone else have a question on URS for Kathy before we turn to Trademark Clearinghouse?
I'll update. Okay. A Trademark Clearinghouse is an implementation. Again, this is a place where if you have one national registered trademark, you can put it in there. Instead of every registry, every new GTLD registry creating their own database, there's one database. You pay one fee, you put it in. There are different models now. ICANN has proposed a model, and some of the registries led by Neustar have come back with a different model. And it has to do with security, it has to do with where the data is available, and frankly, some of us need to follow this too, because it's complicated stuff, it's technical stuff, and it involves the data that will be shown to the registrant. So if there's something in there, so let's say Sun had a trademark for computer services and electronics, and there was a new GTLD called Weather, and someone wanted sun.weather. The Trademark Clearinghouse would show them, hey, there's already a trademark out there, but here's the category of goods and services that it's in. It's electronics, it's computer. Do you want to go forward with your registration anyway? And the registrant should say yes under those circumstances, because it's not a conflict. It's not the same category of goods and services. So we have to watch this implementation because it has to do with what's presented to us as registrants. I don't know. There are two sessions coming up on the Trademark Clearinghouse. One is today from 5 to 6:30, and one is Wednesday from 9 to 10:30. And it would be really great if we had somebody in that room, because I can't make either one, if we had somebody in that room to report back as to what's happening. Because there's a fight going on between the registries and the ICANN staff, and I want to make sure our rights don't get plowed under in the process. So we're looking for volunteers again.
Yes. And I think it's also worth noting that there is some ICANN public comment happening right now on the Trademark Clearinghouse. So this public comment closes on 7 of November. So we've got some time to give this some thought and to submit some comments, either individual comments, constituency comments, stakeholder group comments, whatever we think we can do. This is a place where there's an issue where ICANN is accepting input on. So, does anyone else have anything to say on this? No, you look puzzled.
Okay. Can anyone else think of other people in the constituency who might be able to help? Because we really, really can't let these two. We spent so many years working for the fair balance. We can't let the implementation slip. And, oh, by the way, Constantinos Komitas, and I'm Kathy Kleiman, so we're called KK Squared, and we did a lot of work on this, and now he's with the Internet Society. And it's time for the next generation, guys.
Yes, I agree. If anyone knows of anyone who wants to work on these issues with us, we need the help. Okay. Anything else on Trademark Clearinghouse? Okay, well, then let's move on to the next item on the agenda. Thank you so much for that, Kathy. That was really, really helpful and very insightful. Okay, so the next issue on the agenda is special rights for the Olympic Committees, the Red Cross, and the intergovernmental organizations. And there's a drafting team that's been working on this issue, which Avery and others have been participating in. So if I could ask Avery to give us a bit of an update on what's happening there and what we should care about and how we can get involved, that'd be great.
Thanks. This is Aubrey Doria. So I think the drafting team part of this is at least temporarily over because the motion is going to the council. I think it's already on the council's agenda for this meeting, if I'm not mistaken. And the motion has two parts, one of which supports the notion, the board notion had of the temporary reservation or moratoria, as it's being called, for those names. And the other part basically calls for getting the PDP going as quickly as possible. Now, one of the things that was in this drafting team is that it wasn't looking at all the other names. It wasn't looking at the IGO names. It wasn't looking at the other names that have been put forward of, you know, treaty organizations that are the international NGO sources. So that's not looked in at all. I think it's referenced somewhat in the motion that the PDP would go look at those things. And in fact, it speaks there. And, you know, we talked during the GNSO meeting about that motion and the fact that it includes those names as part of the PDP. So what will probably happen is, and I guess there's commentary out on that at the moment, is that the PDP will get created. I have almost no doubt that the council will approve the PDP, and the PDP then its charter is already proposed. Then it may be that drafting team that gets the, you know, whatever tasks are left in terms of creating that the working group charter. Because actually the charter is not created, just the mission is in there. The other part of this is sort of an unknown, and that's the board's position that if they don't have an answer by the 12th, you know, they will impose the moratorium, but of course, you know, the GNSO proposal now is that indeed the board do go ahead and propose the moratorium. And sort of that's where it stands. I, for one, have, you know, spoken against two things in this. One is I've spoken against the moratorium. I believe that there's time enough for the board to put in any necessary moratorium or moratoria before anybody is actually being delegated. And as they don't need to rush and do that in January. And that if they wait until the PDP has actually had some time, then that moratoria will reflect the work, that temporary one would reflect the work of the PDP. And indeed, the PDP could finish in time if we do it right. So, you know, try and wait until the PDP is over. If you can't wait until the PDP is over and somebody is about to be put into the route, well, then that's the time for the board to take the emergency action that is within the board's purview. I don't know how far that's going to go. The other issue that I've had with all of this is, I guess that was it for my issues with that. It's just that I think they're jumping too quickly. I think, you know, we shouldn't waste any more time. We should get the PDP going as quickly as possible. Get all the issues on the table. Get all the conditions. You know, and as I say, within this group, I think we've got the full scale of opinions from those that say absolutely no new reservations should be created to, you know, we actually need new reservations, but we're not looking at it correctly. There are more organizations that need to be considered, that are being considered. The other thing that the PDP does is it puts in that anything that's good for the new GTLDs is also good for the incumbent GTLDs. Now, of course, no new reservations is what the old GTLDs, the incumbent GTLDs, already have. And obvious, if there are new sets of reservations that are created, then obviously one has to come up with a plan of how incumbent TLDs would deal with those. But I believe, and I think that has been accepted, is that we can't talk about you know, these issues in new TTLDs alone in isolation. That if they need to be protected, then they need to be protected everywhere. If they don't need to be protected, then they don't need to be protected anywhere. And without prejudicing that particular if statement, it has to apply to both, and it has to be seen to apply for both. Though, of course, it makes sense when putting together the charter to sort of, you could, if you come up with a decision that says new reservations are needed, they could certainly be imposed on the new GTLDs more quickly than they could be imposed on the incumbents, because there's obviously a hard process problem to solve with the incumbents of how do you undo what's been done. It can be done, it can be given time, it, you know, any number of creative solutions could come up if that was the solution. And so trying to sort of say all this without prejudicing it too much with, you know, my view of new reservations. I think that's what a PDP has to decide. We have to talk that through. So that's about, I don't know if there's any questions, but that's about where I see that particular process at the moment.
Thank you so much, Avery. Does anyone have any questions on this, this issue?
This is a Bill. I'll just make a comment, which is that I was told by somebody last night that at the GAC meeting, Suzanne said that the GNSO was all on board with the moratorium. Characterize it as, you know.
Right. Well, the GNSO
related
is.
Agreement.
The GNSO is. Unless,
but again,
the
MCS,
unless counselors say no. But at the moment, the drafting team came through with a, you know, near consensus. There was a few of us against it, but they were close enough for it to have support. I was one of the more vocal against it. What happens in the GNSO, you know, it's now up to the council members. But I was a minority voice arguing against the moratorium. The NCSG put in a position that strongly supported the PDP, strongly supported the expansion of the PDP, and did not support the moratorium, but it was a minority. So from her perspective, that would be a true statement unless something changes on Wednesday.
I understand that. I just remain always unhappy and troubled with the lack of acknowledgement of minority positions in all these contexts. It's just throughout the ICANN environment, it just always, so many times when we're opposed to something, it's like just written out of the history, like those Soviet review stands, you know, we're airbrushed out. It's bothersome.
Actually, I disagree with that, because the opinion is in the minority opinion, you know, got voiced, and it is written there. So it is written there, whether Suzanne brings up the minority opinion in the GAC or not. It's not written out. It is there. And I know as a writer of many of minority opinion in many processes over the years, I've often had the wonderful opportunity to quote them 2 years later and say, hey, that opinion was there. You should have paid attention to it. It doesn't get written out. You're right. It doesn't change the world, but it doesn't get written out. It's there. And it's important to put those minority positions.
I don't really want to debate the point so much, but I guess I'm just saying, sure, it's written there. Most people will not ever see it or be aware of it. When you characterize it like that, the GAC members are not going to go back and read the history to find out, you know, so on. So this is sort of a repeated thing.
It's up to you now in the council as a council member, when this is discussed, if you want that negative view on the moratorium to be heard again, it is in your hands. I've done what I can in the drafting team. The NCSG statement did what it could. It's now in the GNSO hands. We've got 6 council members who can make the point that you're making. Really, totally in your hands now.
Well, there actually is another thing that we can do, because there are public comments right now.
open on this issue on the drafting team's report. The public comment period, the initial comment period closes October 19th, so that's pretty quick, and then the reply period closes November 9th. So we've got a few weeks to get this view that Bill's talking about and the minority view out there a little bit more, have a little more statements filed in the community, in the public comment section on this issue. So I think that, you know, that's something that we can do too, is, again, as individuals, an individual sending a quick email to the public comment forum, endorsing the minority opinion, questioning the process by which the drafting team came to the conclusion that it did. I think there's a lot of issues there about circumventing the process. And I think it's worth repeating. It's worth getting it in the public comment. It's worth just being on the record. So when people come back years later, as Ari says, we can say, look, we talked about this. We commented about this, and it was disregarded, but it is there. So that is something that another thing that we can do. Do we have anyone that's interested in writing a comment or marshaling a comment from non-commercial users on this issue? Anyone? Yeah.
Submitted a personal one.
Yeah, great.
And I put in a comment on NCSG's behalf, and we'll speak up at council.
Okay. All right. Is there anything else anyone wants to discuss on this issue? Avery.
I guess I would just add one thing. I mean, one thing that can be done is without, and that's sort of the approach that I took in my comment, is without casting aside the whole notion of a board moratorium, is just telling them, wait until it's actually an emergency. Wait until we know. In other words, if the team really does decide that it's more than just these two organizations that need to be protected, as I say, without us taking a view and prejudicing it, if they decide, then it's wrong to do a moratorium before that excludes them, before it's even discussed. So, you know, the point is, not only is less possible, more is possible. Let's see what a PDP does before the board does it. So you can actually, you know, add something that basically just tells the board, take your time. Give the PDP a chance.
Okay. Thank you very much, Avery. Anyone else on this point? Oh, kidok. Then let's go on to the next issue, which is who is, and the thick who is PDP, the studies, the review team recommendations. Wendy, can you give us an update on who is and what's going on there?
Liz, so we heard a bit from, we heard quite a lot, in fact, from Becky and Matt this morning on the who is requirements and the RAA negotiations. Other things that are going on before council. And so council has the proposed PDP on thick who is coming up for a motion. Avery suggested amendments to the charter to explicitly call out freedom of expression and freedom of association impacts in that charter. In my raising it, in the council discussion over the weekend, didn't get support from around the table for that. So that would be one. So the question is, try and pull up the page here. Let's
since the network is broken, that's not going to work. So, all right. So we've got that discussion where the council could choose to launch the PDP here based on the issues report, which would then go into a long or short process. And I mean, it's, on the one hand, this is almost all existing registries are ThickWhois model, except for the largest ones, the .com and .net registries are a ThinWhois, meaning most information is kept only at the registrar and not at the registry. This would propose both to unify that at, among existing registries and set out policy for new registries. It's important because it says that putting it into the requirements for new registries is a policy development matter, not a mere contractual matter that I can choose on its own. Making the change for existing registries has some potential rights and privacy implications. It's more data collected in more places, and you can't choose your data protection regime merely by choosing a registrar who's in a country that respects data privacy if they're forced to centralize all of the data at the registry as well.
So this motion to develop this this ThickWhois PDP working group, is this something that we should vote for on Wednesday in the council? How do council members feel about the motion? Especially in light of not taking these concerns into consideration. Because one thing that occurred to me was maybe we could try to offer a friendly amendment on the spot, asking for them to do this, knowing that they won't, but at least it'll be in the record, it'll be in front of the community that they're not willing to take these concerns into account.
Especially since they'd have to vote on not doing it then, as opposed to just...
Mm-hmm. Does anyone have any thoughts on how to handle this, the council meeting this week?
What will happen if we do nothing?
If we do nothing, this motion is on the agenda. I assume it'll pass. I mean, I assume it'll pass in any respect. The question is, do we want to try to change it to make it a little bit better before it passes?
Basically, what would happen is if you put forward a motion to change, and you're changing the charter. You'd be offering not a motion to change the motion. You'd be offering an amendment to the charter. And you would offer it as a friendly. It wouldn't be accepted as a friendly. So therefore, it would be an amendment that had to be voted on, and then it would either succeed or fail.
And the nobody in the registrars would support this?
I don't know whether you can get support at the council level for the amendment when it was something they would have to vote for. It changes the dynamic. Once it's something, you know, they got to vote for, then they got to take it back, and they got to deal with it. It would probably force the vote off by, you know, a meeting. But I don't know. I don't know whether you can get support. I think people support it. I think, though, you've had a lot of people saying, oh, that's a distraction. You know, and it'll keep us from getting the ThickWhois work done. That has to get done immediately. And I think that's the argument you're going to get, is that, and you're also going to get an argument that it's too hard. We don't really understand what freedom of expression and freedom of association means. There's no real thing. The other argument I've got is that's just desires. That's not real. That's, you know.
So that we're arguing about a charter, not about an actual policy, right? And you're just trying to put in a sort of a rights assessment thing, which they've already agreed they should be doing on all of these things, right?
Avi, your recommendation is that we vote for the PDP. Is that...
I don't have a recommendation on voting or not voting for the PDP. It doesn't matter whether we vote or don't vote for the PDP.
What about trying to make it better? What about trying to include the specific rights issue in the charter, and then if they want to vote it down, if they want to make these arguments, they're going to have to do so in the public forum. You
can
know,
we,
it's not all behind the scenes. No, we won't do it.
Can we say to one or two people, maybe a registrar that might be sympathetic, and maybe Thomas, is this before or after the chair vote? Can we say, Thomas, we'd really like some support on this. We're only asking for something to go into a charter. It's not like it's a big...
Thomas has already spoken against it, suggesting that including this in the charter would suggest that would detract from its inclusion in other places where it's not explicitly included in the charter, that because it's already in the framing language of the PDP, we shouldn't call it out explicitly anywhere. While we're on who is, the other topic that's up for discussion is the who is review team report, and we're currently, council is sending a note to the board summarizing positions where positions come out across the board on what's required to implement this report and what would be, whether policy development process would be required. We've said we believe policy development process is required virtually everywhere. Others have said it's required virtually nowhere. We attempted to reach a bit of compromise and with the commercial stakeholders, and they did not agree in the end. So it's just going in as a report on disagreement, which is fine. Notably there, the board also has other input like the SSAC report. Yes, it's very good. So, they set up a framework for, as many of us who have been participating in WHOIS debates for a long time have said, before we can solve the WHOIS problem, we must figure out the purpose of data collection and the purpose of WHOIS, and use that to motivate all of our subsequent questions about should the data be collected better, should it be verified, should it be accurate. And so they set out a they recommend before doing anything, go and figure out what this purpose is after all. And I think that's a very sensible suggestion that ties in with suggestions that the Article 29 Working Party included in their response, that European data privacy law requires that collection and use be connected to the purpose for which data was collected. So let's get ICANN compliant there.
So does that become then a reason for voting against the thick who is? Remembering when you vote against something because of the way it's been restructured, it's not only abstaining that lets you make a statement. You can request to put a statement in with a negative vote or even a positive note. You can record a statement that goes along with the votes. Is with part of the new GNSO practices. So I'm just asking the question, not necessarily recommending, but if there's an SAC recommendation that says do this first, is there any reason for us to support that? Probably more of us should read it before we decide to support it, but we haven't till Tuesday. But is there a reason to consider that that is something we need to do first? And I'm just asking.
It is. Maybe mention it in this statement. Make a statement. I think that's really great to hear that we can make these statements now when we do votes, because I think we should regularly do those just to explain our rationale, explain our voting, and get it in the record every time, whether it's a yes or a no vote.
It used to be just abstention, so sometimes if you had something to say, you would have to abstain just to have the ability to say it.
So that rule was actually changed to allow a voting statement with either an affirmative or a negative vote, as well as an abstention.
Any other thoughts on this? Recommendations? Milton, Kathy.
I just want to encourage our NPOC colleagues to, I know you haven't been directly engaged in some of these issues, but I just wonder what you think about this.
I think if I may speak for myself, I think that we are in a learning curve just based on the time that we have spent in looking at these issues. And there's nothing that I've heard today that I don't think is unreasonable or that I wouldn't be in agreement with. But my reserve, and I don't know about my colleague, my reserve is still hesitation about my knowledge base being sufficient to, but as I see it, I'm in agreement with that, and I think that those reserve explanations should be made when you vote. Rationales for your argument?
I would like to make an additional comment here. That's Klaus Stoll from NPOC. One of the stages in what we decided in NPOC is that we need to find ways, and we are concentrating at the moment, actually we have a meeting about that after this meeting, is to relate these issues in a human language way to the NGO and the non-profit communities. And we see our role at the moment more in the educating and getting the message out and getting the issues out, collecting the feedback, and then getting that feedback in the policy-making process instead of basically basing it on the private opinion of two or three people sitting in a meeting. I understand that this sometimes can be frustrating because it seems we are quiet or uninformed or something. No, this is not the case. What is the case? We decided on an internal process, and we are in that internal process, and all I have to say is, please be a little bit more patient with us, because what we are trying to do is to inform, get the information out, and then convey the information. On the other hand, I just want to say again, congratulations, for example. We had until now three excellent reports, and that helps us a hell of a lot of getting that down. And for example, at the moment, as a membership guy of NPOC, I'm learning at the moment that even my little limited ICANN speech, and I'm really trying to get it as small as possible, and I'm getting feedback now. What is a DNS? What are you talking about? And I have to do that. Otherwise, what sense does it do for me or for NPOC or for anybody to recruit members when the members don't know what they are talking about? And it takes time. And I think that's our role at the moment, and that's what we're taking on as NPOC. And you will see, just as an internal information, just to give the 30 seconds more, you will get in the next few days, you will see messages that we start a series of webinars, that we are starting different events at meetings, including the WISIS, and most important, also with other partners, for example, with telecenter.org and things like that, people who are normally never turn up in the ICANN process. And my hope is it takes a little while, but hopefully we get a little bit more informed, a little bit more substantiated membership reply, which then we can feed in better into the process. But my basic democratic question I always ask myself in everything I'm doing is, who voted for me? And who voted for me? And at the moment, if I can't answer you that question, I better shut up.
Alain Béranger, NPOC. I would concur with that. I would also like to mention that the membership of NPOC is in a transition from the original small group, large NGOs, U.S.-centric, to a larger number of smaller, medium-sized NGOs in the rest of the world. And is quite there. We apply the principles of multi-stakeholderism, which is to share information, participate, and call for consultations. But there's no obligations on that group to feedback. So we are in a very early stage of the learning curve of this community. I'm sure you have had the same experience yourself. So, if we ever have strong opinions, we will voice them. But right now, we are just pleased about this meeting and the way the conversation has gone.
Great, thank you very much, Kathy. You were in the queue. Was there something that you wanted to say?
Well, first, thank you for the discussion. If you have questions, if there's something we can do to help those of us who've been doing this for way too long, send us emails and, let us know. The other thing is we had a similar issue in 1999 when we founded NCUC, which is that nobody in the world knew what was going on. And we did have an education outreach effort, which continued. Nonetheless, things are being voted on. Things are being moved forward. So if you see things that go to the core of the rights of the speech, of the expression, of the websites, of the work, of your communities, of the small and medium-sized NGOs, and that sounds like an awesome transition, actually, because you can reach so many more. There's so many of the smaller groups. There's a few great big ones, but so many smaller ones. I would urge you to jump with both feet, because if we don't, and this is what we learned in 99, when the first thing we ever did was just try to stop the UDRP to make it more balanced, and that's where 4C of the UDRP comes from. I'm afraid we didn't have the world voting with us. We just knew something would get hurt. So you're here, and the world, our world, this ICANN world, is in transition. So, feel free to speak. It's hard, but thank you for being
here. Thank you for the information. And it's Klaus again, and those who know me, I'm the first one who jumps. But the thing on the other, and I understand, and you see we are already taking part in a lot of discussions and making comments. But at the moment, I wish that my more or less private comments are based on a broader basis. And I think as broader our basis is, more qualified and the better our comments are. At the moment, it's comments from Klaus plus or Alain plus and so on. As more, if we have a real basis, I think we serve also better. That's just simple. And you see, we are participating, but it is more on a qualified private basis than on a membership basis. Yeah.
Yes, in fact, when we NPOC piloted its first webinar on December 7th last year, Avery was kind enough to be the first or the second lecturer on ICANN 101, and that's the first point. The second point is that that we have NPOC has been approved for a site session at Baku, but we didn't have any travel tickets to go, and ICANN has decided to fund two of our members. But at the time we planned, we wrote up the very rough draft, and I remember heavy criticism because we used the term social sector, but we really meant civil society. But I think it was a matter of language. But all the panelists that have agreed in principle to participate on this NPOC session are actually from NCUC. So I think it speaks that the stakeholders group is already using resources from both constituencies. Of course, we have less resource to contribute at this stage. But that's how I see it going in the future.
Great. Okay. Thank you very much. We've got a couple more issues that are going to be voted on this week that I want to get to. But
people are banging down the door to come in. I think we got to get out of here.
All right. Well, then let's wrap this meeting up, and we can talk about those other issues that are going to be voted on Tuesday, tomorrow, during the NCSG meeting. Is that cool? Okay, and thank you all very much, especially our presenters. Thank you, Kathy, Avery, and thank you so much. Anand, Klaus, thank you.